Yeah, no.
The Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness to come to our colleagues. We have a quick work session, and then we have a whole bunch of people here for informational hearings on trade apprenticeship programs, and then the homeless veterans burial program, which is actually a really good program. I'm going to start out so we can get our business done with opening a work session on SB 661.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 661 was heard on February the 21st. It expresses that monies in the emergency communications account may only be used for prescribed statutory purposes, except in case of fiscal emergency defined as a deficit of at least 12% below the revenue estimate for the biennium. It has a light fiscal impact statement because of the subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means and no revenue impact.
Mr. President, if you would, please.
Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 661.
Senator Courtney moves SB 661 to the floor with subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion? I don't see it. Opposition? So ordered. With that, we're going to close the work session. Senator Marcy is excused today. I don't think she's in all day this afternoon. And with that, we'll close the work session, SB 661, and we're going to open an informational meeting on two topics. We're going to start with veterans in the construction, trade, and apprenticeship programs. We're going to ask Steve Sims, Frank Wall, Bridget Quinn, and Jason Jenkins to come up first, and they even put four chairs up there. Look at that. And there's more than four of you. One of you gets to skip. And since I don't know the order of precedence, I would normally say ladies first, but I will let you four determine who's going to.
I think Mr. Sims is going to kick it off.
Chair.
I got the lower on the totem pole, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Stephen Sims, I'm the administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I would like to talk a little bit about registered apprenticeship in general and specifically our relationship with the armed services and returning veterans. Registered apprenticeship is a structured career learning pathway. It combines supervised, paid on-the-job training with mandatory classroom instruction. It's a highly regulated system. It's different from telling a kid down the street you're going to make him your apprentice mechanic. You're learning very specific tasks and outcomes with theoretical classroom instruction. Most of our programs, their related classroom instruction requires approval either by a national industry association or the State Board of Education. So it's a really regulated, regimented system. Our programs do, I believe, a very good job of extending a welcoming hand to returning veterans in the state of Oregon, not only in honor of the service that they've performed to the country, but also because they're really good workers. As of March 22nd, yesterday, we had 683 active veterans in our program out of a total of 7,979 apprentices, so about 8.6% of our current apprentices are veterans. In calendar year 2016, 87 veterans completed their apprenticeship training and received their journey cards. When these veterans come into our program, they frequently have credit that they've accrued working in their military occupational specialty while serving. There are a bunch of different ways to get that experience. The military does run its own registered apprenticeship programs in about 23 different occupations. Those individuals who go through military apprenticeship programs have very good documentation of their on-the-job learning and their classroom instruction. You also have individuals who are not in a formal apprenticeship program in the military, but they are assigned a military occupational specialty where they do that work, but it may not be as structured as the individuals in the apprenticeship program. In welcoming returning veterans, all of our programs are required, veteran or not, to award credit for relevant prior experience in the trade or occupation when an individual comes into a program. In other words, if someone signs up, they're approved for an apprenticeship program, that apprenticeship committee has to receive documentation saying, I've worked in these areas, I've had this education, which matches up to the skill areas in your program standards, and they will be granted credit towards their apprenticeship in those areas. With respect to the licensed trades, Our programs, our apprenticeship committees, use the same standards that the Building Codes Division uses in evaluating prior experience for plumbers and electricians and all the different electrical specialties. So what's important is that in order for this experience to be credited to the individual, they must be able to document relevant work that is directly related to the scope of work in the apprenticeship standards. If you were to look, for example, at apprenticeship standards for military electricians, there are three different categories of military electricians. They do not always match up with our electrical standards. So building codes and or an apprenticeship committee would look for that documentation that they have work in the appropriate areas to match that of the apprenticeship program. No licensing board, no apprenticeship committee can issue credit or permit an individual to sit for a license absent that proof that the applicant's training and experience is at least equal to the standards for the electrical or plumbing program prescribed by state statute. If a veteran can demonstrate that they have attained the specific training and experience necessary in the licensing category, they will get credit for that time that they've put into the program. I'm going to move on a little bit and talk about when veterans come to our programs, the things that our program and our office at the Apprenticeship and Training Division tries to do for these applicants. Most of our apprenticeship programs will allow veterans to apply for their programs, veterans who have completed their military service in the last 2 years, at any time, even if the program's not currently accepting applications. In other words, if a member of the general public wanted to get in, we're not accepting application. If a veteran comes in, they will accept and evaluate that application because they want to capture that worker, that good worker. In addition to that, most of our apprenticeship programs award credit to individuals coming from the military in their point or evaluation system. Applicants apply, they give their background, experience, training, education, and they are usually ranked based upon those factors. Military service members usually get credit for any training, skill, and education that they received in the military that's relevant to the trade. They also receive, in most programs, points just for their number of years of service in the military. Most programs will directly place eligible veterans applying for an apprenticeship program onto their list of eligible applicants if they can document that they were honorably discharged within the last 2 years and that they can document any applicable service that they have that relates to the committee. All of our programs were approved by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to allow those apprentices to use their GI Bill benefits to support their apprenticeship. And that's really important. Some of our apprenticeship programs do charge tuition. They have books, they have fees. They can use their GI Bill benefits to pay those costs. The additional funds paid under the GI Bill can offset or serve as a stipend for the reduced wages that the veteran will be receiving at the early stages of their apprenticeship. As you should know, or hopefully know, apprentices start at a lower wage than journey level and they get increasing wages as they move through. Those GI Bill benefits allow them to make up for some of those lost wages in the early stage of apprenticeship. Our office at the Apprenticeship and Training Division also coordinates with the 152 apprenticeship programs in the state to provide staff outreach to at veteran job fairs, at stand downs when veterans return to make sure that they understand what apprenticeship is, and equally important, understand that they can get credit for the experience for the time and experience they've accrued in an occupational specialty in the military. Unless the committee has any questions, I will turn this over to our panelists.
Please proceed. We'll do questions at the end.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. I'm Frank Wall. I'm the executive director of the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. My 175 contractors employ over 3,000 plumbers, pipe fitters, and HVACR technicians throughout the state of Oregon. Of those 3,000 members, we have 400 currently that are serving an apprenticeship. I serve as the chair of the Joint Apprenticeship Training Council, also known as the JATC. You might hear that acronym. I'm also currently the vice chair of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. When an apprentice applies for our program, our simple goal is we want them to graduate, and we want them to have a successful career. And that's what we do from the start to the finish. Over a 5-year or 10-term timeline, they earn while they learn. So our apprentices go to school. Ours particularly go to school at night twice a week. They get 2,000 hours in the 5 years, and they work 8,000 hours on-the-job training, and they get paid while they go to school. The members and the contractors invest in that collectively. We estimate we spend around $10,000 per year on each apprentice just for the schooling alone. That does not anywhere near come to the cost of what they get in the workplace. Most of our apprentices come through the normal application process that Steve was talking about, but the state of Oregon does allow us to have exemptions to bring in individuals on what we call direct entry. The military is one of the exemptions we can use for that. Over the last decade, more than 2 million men and women have served and sacrificed for our nation. But despite being a disciplined and highly trainable population, military members face an exceedingly high unemployment rate upon their retirement from the service. To ease that transition back into civilian life, our industry established the Veterans in Piping program to equip military service members preparing to leave the service with sought-after skills that can lead to lifelong careers in the increasingly in-demand pipe trades. This program is an 18-week accelerated course where the individuals come out with certifications that immediately allows them to be of need in the industry. For that 18 weeks in our program, they come out and get 3 terms of credit. So they will start out after they come in as a 4th-term apprentice with a wage scale at that rate. How do we do this? It begins with recruiting military personnel prior to their discharge. So they have an application process at their base. We have 8 bases throughout the United States. We give them the information and they can apply to the program. This allows them to be immediately placed for a good job in the private sector. So while they're still in the military, they do this 18 weeks. And when they leave, we have a placement service, placing them close to the home where they grew up or where they want to relocate to. Now, this process was made possible as a result of the Congress enacting what they call the VOW program, to Hire Heroes Act, in 2011. Before that, we couldn't do that. We couldn't have a relationship with the military that would allow us to coexist in a program. So our industry pays for this program. It does not cost one dime of federal money to instill this. This is our commitment to the program, to the need to get highly qualified people. It has been recognized as one of the most effective veteran assistance programs in the country. It successfully placed over 1,000 returning veterans into gainful employment in various industries, especially construction. Upon separation, the active duty personnel have to reestablish every aspect of their lives, including new careers. So for many veterans, we notice that trying to secure work is one of the hardest obstacles they will face. Meanwhile, it's no secret that the construction community is in dire need of young, capable workforce. With the average age for welders, for instance, is 54 years old. The American Welding Society alone anticipates a shortage of 216,000 welding professionals by 2020. As our country looks to rebuild its infrastructure, the need for highly trained, quality welders also increases. So to recap, why do we want these people? They're high-caliber recruits. As we face a shortage of skilled labor and highly anticipated increase in future projects, we need to recruit these tens of thousands of well-trained, highly skilled workers in the coming years. They're high value of military skills. The military personnel are well-trained in the core skill needed in construction industry, which is leadership, discipline, focus, organization, and most importantly, teamwork. And they provide a reliable source for recruiting high-skilled workers in our industry. Plus, at the end, they have a strong work ethic. The UA has a great success in working with veterans. Our members, like service members, receive professional training, understand responsibilities, and know the value of working together as a team. And I'd like to show you a little video that we have that we send out to the military.
D. They have given their all in service to their country. They have left behind families, careers, even their own security. And when they come home, what awaits them? The United Association of Journeymen and Apprentices of the Plumbing and Pipe Fitting Industry of the United States and Canada is proud to offer returning veterans a pathway to a rewarding career. The UA's VIP, or Veterans in Piping program, capitalizes on the skills, the discipline, and the training of our servicemen and women to help them find the civilian jobs they deserve.
I think I'm extremely lucky, because if this had not come along, I don't know where I'd be.
Exiting servicemen and women can enter the UA's apprentice program at a level commensurate with their training and skills. Membership in the United Association also affords them valuable protections and benefits. They have free access to journeyman upgrade training to keep them on the cutting edge of their craft and ready to take on ever new and challenging work.
The resources that they've been able to procure for us and have in place before we even got here were just outstanding.
Whether veterans or reservists, the United Association has opened its doors to offer them rewarding careers with good pay and benefits. It is our way of saying thank you for your courage and for a job well done.
Thank you.
Madam, go ahead.
Yes. You listed, I want to write them down, those elements that a veteran or that a soldier has: focus, discipline, organization. Could you relist those?
Sure. Yeah. So I do it. It was, I'll get it exactly.
Yes.
Excuse me for a second here. They have, number one is leadership. They've learned to lead. In most cases, they've had that experience, which a lot of people don't get in our public school systems nowadays. So it's really, in our industry, it's so important that we're looking for supervisors, we're looking for foremen, we're looking for supervisors, people that lead teams and crews. That's the number one thing that they can bring to a job, gets the job done on time, done right. They do that. Their discipline, they show up, okay? They're used to showing up. They're used to calling in when they can't show up. They have a sense of order in their life, which is extremely important. Their focus. So when you give them a task, they're used to being having a task. So they know what the start, they know what the end is going to be, and they know what they need to do to get there. So their focus is extremely important. And then, again, going along with that, they're organized. They're used to being organized, so their sense of organization or operational efficiency is, you know, next to none. And then they love being in teamwork settings. So, you know, what we have is our apprenticeship program is just an extension of what they're used to. They're used to a basic training program. And then when they come to our program, what they love about it and what they love about the 5 years or even the 4.5 years is that they have a sense of team, that there's not a sense of entitlement that they get because they don't like that, and they grow through the process, and they really excel at it.
Thank you.
Just a quick question regarding, you have one of your training facilities is there in Tualatin, is that not correct?
Chair Bolkus, right. Yes, we have 6 training centers. So we have a Tualatin training center, we have a Salem training center, we have one in Eugene Springfield, one in Redmond, mm-hmm. one in Coos Bay, and then also one actually in Eureka, California.
Yeah, I think I spent a Christmas party at the one at, or one of those parties.
The one at Tualatin.
At Tualatin, yeah. Go ahead, young lady.
Thank you. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Bridget Quinn. I'm a journey level electrician with IBEW Local 48. I sit on the Clackamas Workforce Partnership Board, and currently I'm now at the NECA IBEW Electrical Training Center. My position there is to do workforce development, mainly outreach to try to bring folks into our apprenticeship program and make sure that they're successful in our apprenticeship programs. Steve Sims did a great job, as well as Frank, describing how apprenticeship works. Once folks get in through our apprenticeship process, they're tested, they're interviewed, and then placed with an employer. With that employer, with that contractor, they're going to be paid an hourly wage. And as they advance through their training, that wage is going to increase. Our training center, just as Local 290, we're self-funded, so we are not receiving any government money to fund our training. for our industry. These folks are placed in a group with their peers, and they advance through the training very similar to what they had experienced in the military. So they have their peers with them along the way as they go through their apprenticeship training. They attend 10 terms of classroom instruction, so 180 hours per year, and that starts off pretty basic, electrical theory, and then it gets more specific into individual niches of our market and our industry. They're doing this all on a full scholarship, so they're getting full tuition, full coverage for their books, even their first set of hand tools to cover the cost of their classroom training, in addition to receiving their high wages as well as benefits through their employer. What contractors expect of apprentices, they expect them to have reached a certain benchmark of skill as they go through their apprenticeship training. BOLI tracks their progress as far as how many hours they get under each discipline, so that when they journey out, they're a well-rounded journeyman, that they can go out to, and be dispatched to a job, and that contractor can be confident that that journey-level worker is able to perform the tasks involved. We do craft certifications, so we have 5 levels, and that's a hands-on test that our apprentices go through every year to pass each level of their craft certification, as well as weekly book tests, classroom tests, that sort of thing. When they complete their 8,000 hours of on-the-job training and their 10 terms of school, they then sit for their state license exam. And for us, since our jurisdiction covers North Oregon and Southwest Washington, they'll typically take a test in both states. And our pass rate for that test is extremely high. We do a really good job of preparing our journey-level workers to pass that exam first try. So we're really successful there. And we spend roughly $6,000 a year on an apprentice just for their classroom instruction. That doesn't count the hours that their employers are putting into them, giving them their on-the-job training and the overhead and their wages. As far as wages go, if you total wages for the 5-year apprenticeship program, they're earning $195,000 throughout their 5-year apprenticeship program. So these are really good wages with really good benefits. As far as what we do for veterans, there are advantages, and we do have a veteran preference. They are, as Steve had indicated, they are able to access their VA benefits when they're in their apprenticeship program. We have what's called direct application. So if we're not open for applications, if someone's a veteran that has been discharged within the past 2 years or is 180 days from an honorable discharge, they can come in and apply regardless if we're accepting applications or not. That is a huge benefit to somebody coming in off the street to be able to apply when we aren't taking applications, because they have the opportunity to earn a high spot on our ranked list right away and perhaps even get in on the next cohort of apprentices that we start off. In addition to the direct application, we have a pre-apprenticeship class that is open for veterans and veteran preference. Our last class in 2016 was made 10% of veteran population, and that 10% then went on and they're now currently apprentices. So they have opportunity for direct entry into the second year of their apprenticeship program after completing that pre-apprenticeship. We take part in Helmets to Hard Hats. We go to career fairs and stand downs, and we're actively trying to access people that are leaving the military. We want these folks in our workforce. We want to do what we can to get them squared away so that they're successful, they're well trained, and when they journey out, they're employable largely. It can be pretty easy for somebody to work their way through or navigate their way through our apprenticeship program, just doing the basic, doing the work, getting through, getting by, passing tests. But what it really comes down to is skills and experience. Is if you journey out and you don't have those skills and experience, it's going to affect you your entire career. You're going to be unemployable for a large part of it. If you journey out, go out to a job site and don't have the skills that are expected of you. I'll take any questions if you have any. Thank you.
Chair Boquist and committee members, my name is Jason Jenkins. I'm an instructor there at the training center also. I'm also a veteran. I went to the nuclear electrical program, and I graduated topped my class, finished up, got out of the service, and decided I want to become an electrician. I joined the apprenticeship program, and with all this background experience I had, it did not prepare me, in my opinion, for what I got into as far as becoming an electrician. And so when I got into the actual electrical trade, I went through the full five-year program. I'm very happy I went through the whole program. As we mentioned before, going through and meeting with the 5 years of being with the same people, getting the same type of team effort that we'd have when I was in the service, it was a very, very beneficial thing for me. I graduated from that program. I became an instructor at the training center, and now I'm on the electrical board in Washington State. I'm kind of lost for words here. but I do think it's a disservice to not get that full 5 years worth of apprenticeship through the program, because to be honest with you, when I graduated from the program, or when I got into the program, I didn't even know what electrical code book was. The NEC is not presented in any way, shape, or form in the military, because we didn't do any construction per se. It was all done through maintenance and theory training. But the reality is when you work in electrical trade in our field, it's all hands-on, new construction, building stuff that we just didn't see in the military. And so I was very happy to be part of this the apprenticeship program. Any questions?
Questions, Madam Vice Chair?
I know you're supposed to. This is veterans,
yes.
But I'm just curious about the diversity within the apprenticeship programs. I come from a very high dense poverty level in my district, and there are a lot of unemployment there. And are there many people with English as a second language, just because we're getting so many more people that speak Spanish in my area that need people who have skills other than, well, English? And are there requirements regarding immigrants? Do you have to be a citizen?
Through the chair, vice chair, I want to say, Anderson, all of our apprenticeship programs have structured equal employment opportunity requirements and active affirmative action programs. Statewide, for all of our programs, we're about at 17.8% minority participation, and that's only protected class minority participation. We're not required to count participants outside of the protected classes. We are at 6.7% female participation, which is distressingly low. We do know that, but I will state we do have the highest minority participation in construction trades in the country, but it's still distressingly low. I think Mr. Wall or Ms. Quinn could talk a little bit more detail about English as a second language and non-English speakers. We do know that some of our programs offer ESL classes to apprentices as a condition of completing their first term of apprenticeship, but every program has different challenges regarding that particular issue.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, sure. I'll speak for the electrical apprenticeship program. As far as our diversity numbers, we have 13.4% female, which is still, as Steve says, devastatingly low. However, it's higher than the national average, which is, I believe, 2 or 3%. Diversity, we are at 22.5% for people of color. As far as English as a second language, one of the benchmarks for applying into our apprenticeship program is to pass a reading comprehension and an algebra test. So if they can pass that reading comprehension and algebra test, they've met the benchmark as far as being able to qualify for an interview and get into our apprenticeship program.
Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions?
Chair and Vice Chair, Senator Anderson, we would be similar in the program. But what I think is really important, and Steve indicated, we need to mirror our communities. So veterans are just one component when we look at, you know, we interviewed 700 people last year. I mean, there's a real desire. Our struggle is to find mechanical intelligence, because we don't have CTE programs that work that way, that can pre-identify or actually put passion in an individual to do that. So we have an extensive outreach program. We're connected with the Oregon Tradeswomen, Construction of Hope, any group that we can get involved with. We want to get involved with through the pre-apprenticeship program and bring them in. So veterans are extremely important, but actually to have the blend And we're very, you know, we use our exceptions when we can. So if we can find someone in the community that, that wants to come with us, we're going to take them.
Good to hear. Thank you.
Go ahead, Senator Olson wants to ask a question. Go ahead.
No, go ahead if you want to.
No, go ahead first.
All right, thank you. I had the pleasure to chat with Mr. Wall the other day. I came to my office, but I do have a question for you in your handout here. The bases that you mentioned, there's seven or eight of them, I believe, eight. Do they have these MOSs, which is what their military connotation is for what they do? Do they actually have these MOSs at these bases? So they teach welding and pipe fitting at Fort Carson, Colorado?
Yes.
So that the MOS is established there?
Yes.
Okay. And all the bases are the same? They teach different things?
Well, primarily most of them teach welding, but we do have a base that will teach, specialize in HVACR, for instance. So we also, so for instance, we get ours in Oregon from Fort Lewis. So most of our veterans in piping have been in Fort Lewis that have identified that they've actually, you know, gone to high school here in Oregon or college and come back and then want to reunite with their families here. So when they have a whole human resource department as far as how they identify and notify us saying, we're going to have an individual in 18 weeks. They're from, you know, Bend, Oregon, and they want to find something in Bend. That's our issue is then when if we can – not a problem in Portland, but when we want to go into rural Oregon, finding the opportunities for them to go to their home to find a job became a little struggle. So it's a creative placement that we have.
A follow-up. And the reason I asked this question was is that I just wanted to clarify that you weren't going to artillery base to pick up pipe fitters. And that's why I asked the question.
Yeah. Chair Boquist and Vice Chair, we're a little different than maybe the electricians. Most of our work is contracted out through contractors at bases, so you're not seeing a lot of med gas that the plumbers would do or some of the orbital welding that you see that we have at Intel. You're not seeing, you know, condo units where you're having HVAC units or prefabricated plumbing units come in. So the military doesn't really have that. They might have some sort of maintenance that would apply to. Most of these people have identified earlier in their life that they have a mechanical intelligence. They like working with their hands, and they want to find something that will allow them to do that. So they get interested in the program, maybe never having welded before or never worked on a control system. And that's what fascinates them. And we figure in 18 weeks, we have a pretty good chance. Again, in 18 weeks, these people will come out with two welding certs, you know, and they can immediately go to work anywhere in the state of Oregon on these two welding certs. So,
follow up,
please.
Oh, there's where I wrote it down. A lot of veterans go in when they're 18. A lot of people that have come out of the military have started when they're 18. They put in their 20 years and they get out. If they worked in a category, electrician, pipe fitter, whatever, and they had the specifications that you guys required, after 20 years, would they come out and go in as a one-year apprentice, or would they be able to bump up the line a little bit, or do they have to still put in the full 5 years?
I'll just speak for our program, and then I'll let Bridget speak. What we do is we'll bring people in, and they go through a one-year probation. Because sometimes they find out it's just not the right fit. After the one-year probation, they apply to our program for credit, and we can give them credit for previous on-the-job training or previous classroom credit if they give us the documentation that Steve was talking about where we can verify that. They also have the ability to test out and challenge. So there's a building traits test they can take, you know, and they can take a Class 5 boiler. If they've done enough of stuff, we can refer them to do that. So there are opportunities to accelerate. But again, I haven't found in the history that I've worked for the last decade in the JTC that I've had one veteran that has asked for that. It's not out there. But if it was, they would be treated like everybody else that we treat that gives credit in the program. We wouldn't want to hold them back.
What about the electrical side?
I'll echo what Frank said. There are mechanisms in place to qualify for advanced placement in our apprenticeship program, but in the history, no one has ever made that request. They would need to be able to document that they have reached the level of certain hours and a certain discipline for each part of our trade in order to meet that request.
And nobody in the military retiring has ever done that?
No.
Okay.
That's because you have gray hair, Senator. And if we had my way, we'd have national service, and we wouldn't have all those bloody contractors in those bases, and they would know how to do what you're doing.
Gotcha.
But the fact of the matter is, and I would have to agree, and it's the number one thing I saw in visiting all the senators, centers, training centers, being one of the lone Republicans that's actually gone and done that, is exactly what you said, and that is we don't have CTE training, and we don't have strong math skills. And the single number remedial, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to, but what I've been told all the way across the board and what I've seen is you know, even in basic welding, mathematics has become the biggest downfall. I do find it very intriguing, though, that there must be something we're doing right in the military, because if the veterans are passing at the rate you're talking about, that means they've had probably some additional mathematics skills taught to them in the military, because when I've visited all the centers, hence the problem, as you said, ma'am, they had to pass an algebra test.
Mm-hmm.
I'd take it three times in college, by the way, but that's so I'm not an electrician. But that's our problem, is you know, I think we, if we did a better job at CTE and we did a better job at mathematics, it'd be easier for all four of you to fill those vacancies that we have out there. And I'm assuming, generally speaking, on an annual basis, you have vacancies.
Mr. Chair, the mathematics part comes in with projectile drop over a certain yardage.
Other questions? There's other questions? Thank you very much. We'll ask the second panel to come up, Charlie Johnson and Jerry Henderson.
This is my bill, by the way.
Thank you very much.
This is a bill. For apprenticeship training.
Gentlemen, how are you? One of you can lead, follow, or get out of the way.
Well, Charlie will take the lead.
Thank you, Chair Boquist and committee. My name is Charlie Johnson. I'm the business manager and financial secretary treasurer for the sheet metal workers. I also serve as secretary for our apprenticeship program. I spent about 18 years as an instructor for our apprenticeship program prior to being the business manager. And I'd like to briefly talk about how we do work with veterans. There's been a large development over the last couple of years with our international organization with the helmets to hard hats. They've kind of gone through some struggles here and there, but things have really gotten better. Daryl Roberts, the lead for the helmets to hard hat, is actually was a sheet metal worker. Who now heads up that. There's a direct link within Helmets to Hard Hats software that connects with our national training software as well. So when a veteran says that they're interested in the sheet metal program through the Helmets to Hard Hat, they get to choose which area of the country as well that they may like to relocate to. And so that software then emails the appropriate area. I received 5 of them in the last 2 or 3 months where, you know, this particular candidate gives us their name, their telephone number, how we can reach that particular candidate from the Helmets to Hard Hat program that says, you know, they're interested in our apprenticeship program, at which point we reach out to those candidates and give them a bit more information about what the requirements are to get into our apprenticeship program. Credits as well, they get an additional point setting just for producing a DD-214 discharge forms. So we do give advance credits for that type of stuff. We're also in the process of it's kind of brand new. It's not official yet. It's in development. But our training center that is in DuPont, up outside of Fort Lewis, they're working directly with the Fort Lewis people and coming up with a Smart Heroes program where the people who are getting discharged from Fort Lewis who qualify, they would go to 8 weeks worth of intensive training at our training facility in DuPont. And after that 8 weeks of training, they could go, you know, pretty much anywhere and given a year's worth of credit within all of our apprenticeship programs. That qualifies them for a year's worth of program. We have We've produced, I think that, each of you have some of this, we've produced literature that might be appealing and you know, catch the eye at the career fairs of veterans. So that's just some of the different things that we do to assist veterans getting into our program.
Thank you.
I'm Chair Boquist and Senators. I'm Jerry Henderson with the Sheet Metal Contractors Association in Portland, SMACNA, is maybe for more familiar to you. I serve as the chair of our JATC, been on the JATC for over 9 years now. I was a contractor in a previous life, large mechanical in Portland, Oregon. Also employs not only sheet metal workers, but plumbers and pipe fitters, electricians, and an occasional teamster. So a lot of experience with different trades. The expectation of our contractor members and the abilities of the apprentices that come out of the program is to have a certain work level when they're dispatched to the employer. And a concern that we would have is if those apprentices that were potentially not going through the full five-year program were to be dispatched, would they have that base level of knowledge that to come out and be employed? That's a primary concern. We obviously welcome veterans. We love the work ethic. We love the discipline. We love all the things that Frank Wall had talked about earlier. We appreciate their service. We have the greatest respect for veterans, and certainly would love to have more of them apply. But we need them. We also need them to be qualified when we send them out to be employed. We don't want to set them up for failure. If they come out of the program unprepared, then they will not be able to be employed once they're out in the real world, per se. We lose our ability to protect them once they leave our apprenticeship program. So it's real important to us that when they go, they're very well-rounded and they're very well set to go. And just so you know, when we talk about an apprentice in our program, they come in making $19 an hour base wage. That's their base wage. They also have another roughly $16 an hour in benefits. So a total package of $35 an hour. They need to be able to come out and perform for those kind of wages. We do our best in the JATC to make sure that they're qualified to be able to come out and perform at that level. As Mr. Sims mentioned, we have a little bit of a problem attracting disadvantaged workers into our workplace for whatever reason. It's not for lack of trying. We would love to have more veterans, first of all, and we do all we can to reach out to them and try and get them into the program. We do that with minorities and disadvantaged people in general too. We really make an attempt to try and get that to work to our benefit. But at the end of the day, we need qualified applicants. We've taken some good steps forward with the CTE money that's been allocated over the last few years to try and get that education back into the classroom in the high schools. Unfortunately, we've lost a couple of decades here with kids that have no exposure to the construction trades, and I think you know what I'm talking about. We need them to be able to hold a hammer correctly, use a tape measure, be able to identify what an open-end adjustable wrench is, so when somebody asks them to go get one, they know what that looks like, right? And unfortunately, we've got a couple of generations that have not had that exposure, unless somebody in their families or a family friend has taken them aside and taught them those basic skills. So we support the veterans. We would like to support them at whatever level we can. And certainly would welcome them into our program at any time. So, and we also do what the other trades have talked about as far as making available to them ability to apply for credit. And again, I cannot recall in my 10 years there having had anybody do that. So,
well, just so you know, all six kids that I have know that there is no such thing as a metric crescent wrench.
Very good.
Just one crescent wrench. Now, I will attest to you, I've had people come over and have actually asked that from some of their friends, and they looked at, which is the metric one? No, it's the crescent wrench.
That's good.
Madam Vice Chair.
And I should have asked all of you this, but it's my understanding that they, in an apprenticeship, you do get a wage. When does that start? When do you start getting a wage? I mean,
Senator Chair, to answer the question immediately, the first day that they go to work for one of our contractors, they're making that wage.
Yeah.
And then every 6 months, roughly, you know, depending on if they're not in trouble for something different, they get a pretty substantial increase every 6 months throughout the term of their apprenticeship program.
Okay.
It adjusts by 5% every 6 months. So,
is the wage like a full-time job, or it is?
It is. Yes.
It is.
Oh,
that,
yes. Yeah,
and
they,
I think that's important for people to know that when you go into these programs, you're getting a salary.
Yes, you're getting a salary, and you're getting your training at no cost. So we don't spend quite as much as the plumbers and pipe fitters do on training, but we try and make sure all our dollars get into the classroom. but we do spend a lot on training, and it's pretty darn close. So they're getting over $30,000 worth of education in the time that they're in the program, at no cost to them, and making a wage, $35 an hour equivalent wage, while they're being trained. So. At a base, and like I said, it escalates over that 5 year time. One thing that was mentioned earlier is the need for math, and you might not think that sheet metal was a math intensive trade, but it's probably the most intensive trade with math because of all the design aspects that require layout in our trade. Charlie can probably speak to it better than I can, but we really struggle with getting qualified candidates that have adequate math into our program. The one breath of fresh air from the veteran side is they all come pretty well qualified in that area because they've had to have it themselves. So in the service area. So
Cannon Cockers you were talking about.
And we talk about HVAC, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, refrigeration. You know, we have crossover between plumbing and pipe fitting and sheet metal into some areas, but typically ours is mostly metal formed. You know, we don't do much of anything that's not metal based. We do have some fiberglass and plastic products out there that we're using specialized applications. Most of that's in round configuration, but when you go to manufacture round fittings, it's almost more complicated than the square fittings at times. So math becomes even more complicated. And we build all this stuff. I mean, you see it when you walk through grocery stores. If you look up, you see all that ductwork hanging up there. That's what we do. So anyhow, it's not without technical difficulty. Let's just say it that way.
I'd only like to clarify that your apprentices don't get a salary. They get a fair day's wage for a fair day's work.
Correct.
And that's exactly what they do. They go out there and they work hard to get what they do, and I appreciate it. And math is extremely important. I'm a builder, and it's amazing to ask people to square a wall and they can't figure out how to do it. Even without having to do the mathematics, they can't do it. But the one thing I did learn is never lick your fingers and touch the wire at the same time.
Bridget could talk to that better.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I might respond to that, one of the things that was said by one of our safety professionals is that really we should be classified as industrial athletes, you know, in regard to that fair day's wage for a fair day's work. We're the construction trades is very athletic in nature in a lot of what we do.
Which gets back to the teamwork aspect of it too. I mean, you know the level of qualification and the effort that has to go on a job site to get these huge complicated buildings built. It takes a qualified team and a team driven outlook on getting the job built. So it's all very important.
And Mr. Chair, if you consider the fact of what the people that do the work carry around day in and day out. Bags filled with screws, hammers, screw guns. Electricians carry a plethora of tools, and it's all in the 30 to 40 pound category, and they carry it around and up and down ladders all day long. It is an extremely difficult job, but it's really important that we have them.
We'd just like to have a lot more of them, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. Well, that's, it's kind of, and I will tell you that, you know, we're talking primarily, if I may, Mr. Chair, about my bill, but it was brought to me by Mr. Murray, and I just thought it was a good idea to make certain, and you guys have really clarified the fact that we make certain that we get our folks to work, because when I came back from the time period long before most, that there, you know, the concern for vets wasn't there. We were really, the country was really disenfranchised with veterans, and it's nice to see that there are people out there that want to make sure that these guys come back, and I'd love to see them go right into work, because that kind of, as you look to the future, you don't remember the past, and that's what I'd like to see for our guys, and that's kind of why I did this bill to you know, move it along. But you've made a great point, and I don't know that we really need this bill.
We'll come back to the in a real hearing, okay?
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate the presentation of both panels, and especially appreciate the amount of effort that the contractors and labor together have made in reaching out to veterans, especially those of the last decade that come back from the war, and in trying to help them get reestablished in the communities. So with that, colleagues, we're going to move on to another short informational meeting on the Dignity Memorial Homeless Veterans Burial Program, and ask Crystal Purdy and Liz Estabrooks to come up, if they would, please.
You guys don't have to leave. Man, you've drawn them out of the house here.
There's probably a reason they're being scared away. That's,
I know.
Okay.
Anytime we talk about death, it's kind of scary.
So we talk about that in this committee all the time.
Well, good. We'll get
along. Committee of doom and gloom.
But I recognize this guy, though.
Uh-oh.
You came to one of my homeless veteran services, actually.
Absolutely.
Many years ago, yeah.
As a matter of fact, I still have the flag exactly good. Where I said it would be.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you.
Whomever can start.
Go ahead. I'll be delighted. My name is Crystal Mai Purdy. I wear a number of hats. I am a creepy mortician. I've been one for 11 years, and I think that's kind of why I'm here. I run the Homeless Veteran Burial Program in Portland, and it is a national program with my company, actually, so that's why it's called the Dignity Memorial Homeless Veteran Burial Program, and it is, or should be, available through any Dignity Memorial provider across the United States that is also dependent on kind of the revenue and success of that individual location, whether or not they're able to participate in providing those services. So I embraced the program in about 2009 as just kind of a personal passion, and grew it by developing relationships with different veteran organizations, the VA itself, and the medical examiner. Anybody who would be in a position to find themselves in the care of a deceased veteran with no family who had been homeless. There is certainly a criteria for an individual to be eligible for my program, and that is having had been homeless, potentially having been connected to housing recently, typically low-income housing, and then also to have no family to claim them. And so after many weeks of searching, the medical examiner will then contact me, and I will begin another search through the State Lands Program here in the state to try to find any other next of kin. I'll run an obituary in the newspaper to see if anybody else is willing to step forward. There have been certain situations where family has stepped up later on, or at least, you know, come to the surface to say that we do know this individual, we are a family member, but then sometimes they realize that should they take control of the disposition, there is a significant charge involved through a funeral home. A lot of the time they will take a step back and then just allow me to move forward with the disposition. What my program provides is a dignified burial in a national cemetery. And so to kind of describe how that's significant is, if you take an individual who is unclaimed in the state, There are funeral homes on a rotation with the medical examiner's office. And if there's somebody who is unclaimed, that person will then be basically given to the next funeral home on that list. The funeral home is then in charge of cremating that individual and placing them in permanent storage in the hopes that somebody may come and find them later. The difference in my program is that we do a full body burial, because if there is family that comes back later, and for whatever reason, maybe there is a religious belief that was, you know, against cremation, they have the opportunity to at least claim that body. Cremation is irreversible, so we're not able to go back from there. So my program, sadly, kind of comes at the very end of a very tragic time in somebody's life. And myself personally, I tend to often have this feeling of it's a little bit too little too late. But I also feel very strongly that if that's all we have at that point, then we better give it all we've got. And so over the past 11 years of my career, I have really tried to grow the program, and I value the opportunity to come and share about it because it's not a well-known program. And one of the reasons I feel that has come to the forefront recently is, sadly, we have recently had the privilege of honoring our first lady veteran through the program since I embraced it here in Portland, and that was Casey Finnegan. And so right before I left for New Mexico, we honored her life, and I think that that brought a lot of attention to the program, which is sadly sometimes how it works. So are there any questions about the program?
I have a question, but I'll wait till she's done.
Certainly.
Thank you, Chair Boquist, Co-Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Courtney, and Senator Olson for inviting me to talk about women veterans and homeless women veterans and the precipitating factors of homelessness or factors that put women at greater risk for homelessness. My name is Elizabeth Estabrooks, and I am the Oregon Women Veterans Coordinator with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I am a veteran of the U.S. Army, serving from 1977 to 1980. I went through as the second wave of women to go through the fully integrated co-ed military at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And when I arrived at my station in Kitzingen, Germany, Harvey Barracks, I was one of fewer than 1,000 women on that base and the only woman in my company for 6 months. In 2015, the Oregon legislature joined fewer than 20 other states in recognizing the need for a full-time dedicated women veterans coordinator and passed House Bill 3479. I was selected for that position and began my work just over a year ago. The year began with the biennial Oregon Women Veterans Conference, which was attended by over 300 women, was very successful according to the 93% of the evaluations that were completed. We had workshops ranging from benefits to yoga. Following the conference, I began a listening tour of the state, visiting 23 counties and meeting with over 1,000 women veterans, and have since served directly provided services to dozens of women veterans in Oregon. I have participated in producing ODVA's Oregon Women Veterans Health Study, which was completed in October. What I call intentional planning for services to women veterans is too often overlooked. What this means is that when planning for providing services to veterans, the unique and specific needs of women veterans are usually not considered. I appreciate that you're considering these differences and that you are considering women veterans and homeless women veterans separately from the general veteran population. I will begin today with a brief snapshot of women veterans who are the fastest growing homeless population of veterans. First, we are younger than men veterans with an average age of 48 compared to 63 with men veterans. Almost half of us have at least one child under 17, and 20% have our single parents. In other words, of the more than 28,000 women veterans in this state, over 11,000 have more than one child at home, one or more child at home, and nearly 5,300 are single parents. But there are also thousands of us who are childless, which can itself be a barrier to obtaining services, as many of those are designed for families. Divorce and single parenting are both counted as precipitating factors to homelessness. Unfortunately, we are also less likely to identify ourselves as veterans, and others are less likely to identify women veterans as veterans, rendering us invisible in realms from the personal to the political. The lack of identification of women veterans as veterans has a huge impact on how services are accessed. The intentional planning for services and how services are provided to women veterans along the continuum of services from prevention to intervention to aftercare. In answer to our invisibility, I and the Portland State University Veterans Resource Center launched the I Am Not Invisible campaign in February of 2017. The campaign features 22 Oregon women veterans from across the state, consisting of women across all five branches, from the ages of 24 through 101, who represent a snapshot of the diverse characteristics of women veterans. It was born from the need to acknowledge the invisibility of women veterans and to help serve as a reminder that we are not or should not be invisible. This week, in honor of Military Women's History Week, you can see six of the posters hanging in the South Gallery here, one of whom is Jean Wonowski, who is a 101-year-old woman who joined the Women's Army Corps and became a nurse right after Pearl Harbor. For American Indian, Black, and Latina women, this lack of identity as a veteran is especially impactful. For example, American Indian women serve the military at a higher rate. They are younger as a cohort. They have lower incomes, and they face higher unemployment than non-American Indian women. Black women veterans from age 17 to 24 face higher levels of unemployment. And women of color are largely overrepresented in the federal VA's Women Veterans Homeless Program population. Women of color make up 35% of the total women veteran population, yet they are 71% of the VA's homeless women veterans program. The federal VA states that the top three diagnoses for women veterans are post-traumatic stress disorder, hypertension, and depression. Of these, PTSD and depression are known precipitating factors in homelessness. National studies show that one-third of women veterans misuse alcohol, but because we are less likely to be identified as misusing alcohol and are less likely to report a substance abuse, we are also less likely to receive treatment for that substance abuse. 65% of women veterans diagnosed with a substance abuse disorder have other diagnosed mental health conditions compared to 42% of their male counterparts. Women veterans also have a high rate of co-occurring disorders, which means they have more than one mental or behavioral health diagnoses. These mental and behavioral health issues include PTSD, substance abuse, serious mental illness, major depressive disorder, all of which increase the risk of unemployment and homelessness. Nearly three-fourths of women veterans who are deployed during Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom have at least one combat experience. 59% of Oregon women veterans stated in the 2016 ODVA Women's Health Study that they had experienced some form of military sexual assault, rape, or harassment while on active duty. Nationally, American Indian women veterans and women veterans of color are at higher risk for military sexual assault. Women veterans are also less likely to be identified with PTSD than men, and therefore less likely to receive benefits or treatment. Moreover, the Veterans Benefits Administration has found that there are lower grant rates for military sexual trauma-related PTSD for those service-connected disability claims than other PTSD claims, which disparately affects women veterans. Women veterans who experience military sexual assault are 6.5 times more likely to experience homelessness than those who did not. Poverty and unemployment must be considered and understood as precipitating factors and risk factors for homelessness. The Department of Labor has found that although women veterans have a higher level of education compared to men veterans, they are also more likely than both men veterans and women non-veterans to experience unemployment. In addition, women veterans have lower median incomes than both male veterans and male non-veterans. Women veterans are nearly as likely as men veterans to have a service-connected disability, yet are more than twice as likely to be unemployed than men veterans with service-connected disabilities. Finally, any conversation about women veterans must include the reality of living with trauma. Humans have the capacity to bury trauma, but what we know is that burying trauma does not mean it does not exist. In discussions of how trauma impacts homelessness, we must consider the significant impact of trauma and its consequences. I will use as an example a woman veteran who was sexually assaulted in the military 40 years ago. Something arises in her life that triggers her memory. It could be the news that we're reading today about the sexual harassment and photo sharing being perpetrated by male Marines, or it could be the act of filing a service-connected disability for military sexual trauma. That trigger could be a precipitating factor that leads to substance abuse, mental health crisis, unemployment, and finally, homelessness. How we respond to her crisis can make the difference between her maintaining the stability of a current home or becoming homeless. I met three women veterans over the past year who stand out in my mind as powerful examples of challenges facing women veterans to maintain housing stability. I recently met a woman veteran who is divorced from her physically and mentally abusive ex-husband. She has two children and has military sexual trauma-related post-traumatic stress disorder. She was employed but was injured at work and then received a letter of termination telling her they were cutting her position. She is very worried about maintaining her housing for herself and her two children and is exploring alternatives. Although she still experiences harassment from her ex-husband, even though she has a permanent restraining order, she does not qualify for temporary assistance to needy families for domestic violence victims through DHS because she is divorced and not currently fleeing a violent situation. In considering her alternatives, the shelters are full, so she can't use a shelter. She's renting her home and is receiving a modest amount of workman's comp, but that is insufficient to support her and her two children. I have spent countless hours trying to find help for her, but more and more doors close every day. None of the agencies that provide help with homelessness can help her because she has a home, in spite of the fact that she is on the edge of losing that home. The second woman veteran recently divorced her husband after a long-term marriage. They were both successful and made a combined income in the high three figures. After he filed for divorce, she found out that he had moved every asset into foreign accounts in his name. Battling depression, for which she is service-connected, she moved to Portland, got a job, and was beginning to overcome the financial and personal upheaval she had just experienced when the company she worked for made unemployment cuts, and she found herself with no money, no savings, no job, and no support. While looking for a job, she sought rental assistance so she could stay in her home. The advice she was given after calls to numerous agencies designed to help with homelessness was that in order to get help, she needed to get evicted and go live in the park so they could help her. The third woman veteran I worked with lives in a rural community in Oregon. She was living with a friend, but that was quickly turning into a very bad situation, and she needed to leave. She had no source of income, and there were limited services available. She was told there were no available housing vouchers, and because she was single, she did not have access to temporary assistance for needy families or any other type of cash assistance. When she called me for help, I began making calls. Even with my skills, knowledge, and resources, I spent over an hour being transferred, leaving messages, and getting no help, all to no avail. I finally was able to contact a woman I had called twice at an agency designed to help with homelessness. She promised to help and asked the woman to call her. When the veteran called, the man who answered told her that the woman was only the receptionist and she needed to talk to somebody else, but nobody was available. When the veteran called me back, she was sad, angry, frustrated, and depressed, and it was after 5 p.m. The next day, I called the original woman and explained what happened. She called the veteran and helped connect her to the people who could intervene successfully, but it took weeks for her to get the help she needed. Trying to find housing assistance is a challenge for a professional and almost impossible at times for a woman veteran in crisis. Homelessness is no more tragic for women veterans than it is for men, but the risk factors and precipitating factors are different. These differences mean that we must take these differences into consideration when addressing the issues of housing stability and homelessness for women veterans. The actual rate for homelessness among women veterans, the fastest growing homeless population among veterans, is probably greater than the statistics demonstrate. This is because these statistics are based on what is known as the point-in-time count. The point-in-time, or PIT count, is a count of sheltered and unsheltered persons, homeless persons, on a single night in January. However, women veterans find, or women in general find, that shelters and being on the street is unsafe. So they're less likely to be on the street or in shelters at night. For homeless women veterans, it may mean living in a car, on a friend's couch, in a vacant building, or in a storage unit, which means they're absent from these counts. In addition, because of the issue of invisibility, women are often not asked if they are veterans. Although there are resources available for homeless individuals, one of the biggest challenges is housing stability and not becoming homeless. For women in rural communities, barriers to housing stability can be even greater than those in more urban areas. Thank you for your interest in this important challenge to women veterans. And I'll answer any questions you might have.
Carol, please.
Ms. Pretty, I remember that day well. I was a new senator, and I was amazed at the turnout and the response for this homeless veteran. And I was absolutely flabbergasted that someone had gone to that trouble to do that, and I thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Crystal, what is your connection to veterans? I mean, you've taken on a crusade here.
Yes,
and there were decades some of us were around when, you know, if they even knew, in fact, the three of us, if you experienced this, they would spit on you if they knew you were a veteran.
Right.
In Portland.
I am not a veteran. A lot of people, I think I am. You did when we got here.
So you did.
I was married to a Marine for a short period of time. He had served two tours overseas and had started receiving treatment up at the VA, specifically the prolonged exposure therapy that is provided for some veterans, mm-hmm. and got to witness a very dark turn in somebody I cared about very deeply. And ultimately, our relationship did not work out the way that we had hoped, but he taught me a lot about how to support veterans, how to not support veterans, and just working through that process, and also doing veteran outreach through my work many years ago. I just grew to really love the veteran community. I grew up in Japan, and we're very tradition-based, and I find that there's not a lot of tradition left, you know, just kind of around in the world, and I find a lot of tradition to still exist in the veteran community. There's a lot of respect and a lot of tradition that still exists.
So when you did you reach, because you're part of a nationwide network now, and do you reach out across the entire state of Oregon and to other funeral homes? I mean, you just start picking up your phone and calling, and how do individuals in other communities outside of Portland, obviously the medical examiner in Multnomah County is familiar with this, but
correct.
How widespread in Oregon?
I do a lot of other things too. So I sit on the board of the Oregon Fallen Badge Foundation, so I'm the only funeral director that works with the fallen officers in the state. I am on leadership on a number of nonprofit veteran organizations across the nation, such as Team Red, White, and Blue and Operation Enduring Warrior. I have a very large social media network, mm-hmm. and so a lot of my reach comes from just visibility that I've created for the things that I do through other things that I do. You know, I do a lot of physical events. I mean, I just got back from New Mexico marching the Bataan Memorial Death March. And so doing events like that, you know, it's a huge networking opportunity. And so I have connections through my veteran organizations. So when like a homeless veteran passes away in Hawaii, I get a phone call from a friend of mine who's the advisor to the governor down there, and he says, how do we take care of this? How do we handle this? And I contact my sister funeral home there in Oahu and ask them to take care of it. And so, again, there's not a lot of people who truly know or are very familiar with the actual program here. Just speaking with a couple of people in the room today, they're like, oh, we had no idea that it was a thing. We want to change that. Like, I want people to know it exists. I want to continue inviting the public to be a part of these really amazing, sad experiences. But at Casey Finnegan's service, we had a high school theater group come, and you know, these kids were let out of school for the afternoon to come and experience this incredibly profound event that moved them to have a greater respect for veterans and for just community and outreach in general. And I think that as we were talking earlier, if Ms. Finnegan had known that she could make this kind of an impact, you know, as difficult as her life was, especially toward the end, what a beautiful legacy. And I just want to continue that and impact people in a positive way so that we can then turn to our veterans who are still living and thank them in a really genuine fashion.
There are several of our national cemeteries, of course, that are full, we'll just say, and they are mandating that, you know, new interments have to be cremated. Have you experienced that in Portland?
No, I have not. I know Willamette, I believe, just purchased 80 new acres, kind of right behind. Of course, filling up rapidly. I think they're currently building another columbarium for cremated space, but definitely a real, you know, real issue that we'll be looking at in many years, but not, hasn't been an issue in my time yet.
Well, I'm going to have somebody call you because we actually, we have experienced that issue at Willamette.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, in which, you know, they mandated individuals have to be cremated in order to be buried there. So that's why I sort of asked the questions.
Is that for a second placement?
No, no, that's the original veteran.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so I was just curious if you heard that. But
no, I know if somebody had been cremated, like a spouse previously, and they're placed there already as an urn, then the second person coming in, they're kind of like, well, they should be cremated to be placed with that person too. So that's interesting to me. But
yeah, you know, this is a special forces guy, and he probably had six ex-wives, but he didn't. None of them wanted to be buried with him. So
okay, I was going to say, because that could be a real estate issue.
Yeah, none of them wanted to be buried with him. I'm sure of that.
I see. Because
I knew him for decades. So, but having said that, but yeah, because we've actually tried to have an additional cemetery built there in Oregon. That, because as you point out, we have 330-some thousand veterans here, 26,000-27,000, you know, of the last 15-year marathon of disaster, which leaves us sort of in a rock and a hard spot in the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, homelessness is not going away. It's actually increasing, you know, despite all the, quote, gains in the economy and all of the programs, as you have found out, that we supposedly have, with massive expansion of those programs, and they're not going away. Situation isn't getting any better. And, you know, that's a pretty, you know, just to be blunt, it's a pretty bipartisan problem in the last two present administrations. You know, who knows what will happen next. But I do appreciate all of your donated time and those to veterans, and welcome to the fray. It's hard enough to get this building to recognize veterans in a meaningful manner. Everybody is very good, as you've known, to go thank a veteran, but when it comes to, as you find, trying to find the resource, suddenly they get timid, right, Senator Olson? They don't want to spend money. And so appreciate what you're doing. Good luck with what you're doing. And, you know, we are hopeful that we will win the internal political struggle in this building to recoup the money that was taken away from veterans in the governor's budget. And I will at least compliment the co-chairs at this point who've replaced part of that back, but we're still looking for every damn dime that was supposed to be in there. So, again, appreciate it very much. Anything else?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, a little bit of history in Andersonville, Georgia, where they buried the Civil War guys, they stack them on top of each other. There are several per hole. What I'd like to say is, what can we as the legislative body do to help you get out there so that more people know that you're available, and what can we do to really promote the great thing that you do for veterans?
Thank you. I really think that, you know, my program is more of a, it's a word of mouth, it's an organic, you know, every time you have an opportunity to tell someone about it, if there's an opportunity to say it in front of a media outlet in a positive way, do that. I'm one of the most humble people, so even when I do a lot of these services, I try to avoid the camera and, you know, scoot out of the picture and everything. And so I do feel that I need an advocate or advocates to speak about the programs, to grow awareness, and I would really appreciate that opportunity. Or if there's any situation where somebody would want a speaker to come and speak on something like that. Another thing that I have a really powerful personal passion for is getting out in front of veteran organizations and veterans in general and expressing to them what your benefits, your burial benefits, do not include. There is a tremendous misunderstanding that because you're a veteran or 100% disabled or a veteran of any kind, that my funeral's covered, when in fact it's not. And so that's a terribly painful conversation I've had to have with families over the past 11 years of my career to tell them, well, actually, everything within the National Cemetery is covered, but there's still this $8,000 bill over here that has to do with the funeral home and the casket and the body preparation. And this is a family who has for years believed that the veteran status of their loved one encompasses that. And it's horribly painful to have that conversation.
So I hate to make it more painful for you, but before you were born, we used to cover that, okay? We don't do it anymore.
Do we have all of Crystal's contact information?
I have some business cards, too, so I can leave those.
Would you mind?
Do you have a link or something? And I can ask counsel here, because last time I remember, because we've actually seen them in one argument, believe it or not, I believe the medical examiners have their own association. Like there's a group, an ability at least in the state of Oregon to reach out to all 36 county sets of medical examiners, mm-hmm. Which is just beyond the one you have. Mm-hmm. That you, and I'm assuming you with Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington,
yes.
Primarily, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there are other, at least in that category, I believe there is an association or a regulatory oversight entity that has access to all of the medical examiners, in which at a minimum we could, you know, provide them your information mm-hmm. to them across the 36 counties. Can't speak for Washington because they don't get along with us. And I certainly can't speak for the Federalists because they don't like us.
No, I would absolutely love that. And I've just turned into a facilitator kind of in the state. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a conduit of information and I facilitate a lot of relationships. So even if I personally am not the one that's able to handle the case, I would find someone near mm-hmm. where that veteran is and make it work.
Could you track down? I believe there is a medical examiners association or something close to that. If not, there's obviously one of our boards or commissions regulates the medical examiners, and we should be able to find that sort of list where the committee could reach out to them on your behalf and at least give them the information.
Thank you. That'd be wonderful.
And this building here is one of the largest mouthpieces in the state.
It's full of hot air, too.
Yeah. And we can certainly get that information out, which I really, really congratulate you on what you do.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And like Thank I said, you. I still have the flag.
Thank you to both. And with that, we are concluded for the day. Thank you. We are concluded for the day.